This episode is brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. We've been making cheese in Wisconsin since before we were even a state, which may be one reason why we win so many awards for it. It's what happens when a whole state dreams in cheese. Find your next favorite cheese at wisconsincheese.com.
You're listening to Item 13, an African food podcast, and I'm your host, Yom Akuaku. Every week, we'll delve into the delicious world of African food, including chefs, curators, and bloggers. Here's the show.
Excited to have Abna Ofejima on the show today. We're going to be talking ancestral foods, which is an interesting term for me when I came across it, which is why I reached out to Abna. I've been following your work for a while now, and I've always wanted to have you on the show. I always say that it's interesting. I don't know if it's by design, but I tend to follow a lot of Ghanaian people just because I'm from Ghana. And so I try to temper my excitement for people in Ghana to make sure that I represent other people from the rest of the continent. But I'm always excited to have Ghanaians on. So welcome to the show. Can you hear me?
Thank you for having me.
Great.
Yes, I can hear you. Thank you for having me.
Great. Okay, so we're going to start the way we do with everyone in terms of you introducing yourself. So tell us a little bit about you, where you grew up, maybe your educational background and your connections to food.
Yeah, thank you. I was born in Ghana, so I was actually born in Bolgatanga, in the Upper East region of Ghana. And then I left to Toronto when I was young. So about 11 years old was when my parents decided to move to Toronto. So, just like most Ghanaian parents, right? I think for a lot of us, our parents, we're looking for, quotations, better education, right. greener pastures. And I think for some parents that left Ghana, some of our parents that left around that period, you know, 20, 30, 40 years ago, for many of them, Ghana was not really livable, right? Ghana was not the space that they could potentially see their children doing great, great things, right? Not to say great things are not happening here, just like economic, social, political right. context. So I grew up in Toronto. I grew up in the Jane and Finch community. I went to middle school, high school, university. It was all like 5-minute walk away from where I live.
It's so funny. When you said Jane and Finch, it took me a second because I lived in Toronto for a year. And Jane and Finch is where I would go get my African food fix.
Exactly. Jane and Wilson. Yes. Yeah. So, and initially my interest was to be a lawyer. I was very talkative and I loved reading. And I was like, okay, I'm going to law school. But then I did a weekend, like the LSAT course. And I was like, oh no, this is ridiculous. There's no way I'm doing this and paying this much money for law school. But I loved writing. So I thought I would do graduate school. So I pursued a master's in women and gender studies. And I loved it. I loved my master's. And then eventually I pursued a PhD in social studies. Doing research around Black farming settlements and histories in Toronto. In Canada. So Black farming settlements in Canada. But eventually I left that. So that's a different story. But how I got into food was I've always struggled with allergies as a child. I can be in conditions that are too hot. Every single pore in my face inflames. Like eggs have always made me nauseous as a child. Like if you're frying eggs, I can't be with anyone frying eggs. I cannot be in the same room. Anything to do with eggs just makes me nauseous. If we're close friends, you might, right? You might have to give up eggs at some point. So I was like that. I was very particular with food. So I eventually started cutting a lot of food out. Then I went to visit my uncle in Japan and I consumed a lot of raw foods, right? Like I ate a lot of raw, like sushi and all these other things. Mm-hmm. And it disagreed with my stomach. So when I was coming back, I had a ton of allergies. This is like 2021, bad allergies. Since then, I have not literally been the same, but there were so many foods I could not consume. So I stopped drinking milk. I stopped eating cinnamon, baked goods. Every time I ate something, every single pore in my face would inflame. So at one point I remember my allergies were so bad that the only thing I was consuming was raw sweet potatoes and, red clover leaves boiled because I just had to cleanse. So it was bad. It was bad. Yeah, it was horrible. It was hard. I've been to the dermatologist, allergist. They've put all those testing on my hands. I've done the patch on my back, don't shower for 3 days, just eat. We want to know what's wrong. So anyways, I became a vegan, plant-based, but it was around that time that I saw an ad for, they were looking for youth farmers for the Black Creek Community Farm at Jane and Steele's. And for me, I thought that was like 2013, 2014. Mm-hmm. And it was perfect because I was struggling with food. Like food is not it's a big deal for me, but it's not a big deal. But I'll get there because I struggled, right? Everything I ate, I reacted to. Every single pore in my face would inflame. I literally looked scary, you know? So I wanted to learn how to grow my own food because I was like, there has to be something in the food that's causing this. Mm. So I started working at Black Creek Farm. I became really plant-based. I was doing well. My skin was great. Of course, occasionally I'd eat fries and it would flare up. You know, I would eat like cinnamon bun and it would flare up. But there were a lot of things that I cut out and I realized that eating plant-based was great for me. Mm-hmm. But when I started farming, you know, to be able just to hold the seed and put the seed in the soil and see food come out of that in 3 months blew me away. Because when you live in the city, you're so disconnected, right, mm-hmm. from where food comes from. I used to be a coordinator for a school garden in the community. And I would ask children, like, we grew potatoes. And I would ask them, you know, where do fries come from? And children would say McDonald's, right? So there's a huge disconnect. And I don't blame them actually, because most fries is actually corn flies, not potatoes. So for me, that moment, right? It's like McDonald's. But that moment was like my aha moment, 2014, where I was like, I want to farm. I want to grow food. I want to be able to know where my food comes from. And that year, I learned a lot about food justice and food security, food systems and the history, mm-hmm. just learning about Black farming settlements and food and, you know, racism in food and discrimination and like the land, right? And Indigenous people and land and the tensions in Canada and the history. And that completely shifted. That shifted my perspective. And I was like, this is what I want to do. So I started a PhD, but then I realized that the graduate journey at that particular time wasn't for me. Mm-hmm. So I left. And then I came to Ghana in 2017 and I wanted to learn. I wanted to learn what is happening around food and agriculture in this context, because around that period, like in the 2013, 14, 15, a lot of farms in Ontario and in British Columbia were becoming organic, right? Like organic was becoming the hot label. Like, oh, is this organic? Is this local? You know, like I know the farmer's market, right? Like all these, like, you know, fancy language. And and a lot of us, when folks come back home to the continent, people assume that a lot of the foods you're consuming on the continent, depending on where you are locally grown, you know? But in fact, that's not the case now, you know? A lot of foods are actually imported. Yeah. Even chicken, right, is like imported.
Tomatoes and even plantains.
Imported, yeah.
I read some time ago, it's just like what?
Yes, it's actually very scary what's happening. And because it's part of a larger conversation mm-hmm. around ownership, right? Like ownership of food systems, but also ownership of our seeds and our Indigenous seeds. But yeah, so around that period, I became, in 2017, I came, I traveled to the North. I worked with different organizations. I did my own fundraising because I wanted to learn. I'm like, I love food and farming and the land and the earth and the soil. But I'm not quite sure what direction I want to take it. But I came and I learned a lot about ancestral food, and I learned how much our indigenous foods were declining, you know, were dying off, and seeing baobab trees that were dying, a lot of our local foods being substituted with foreign foods. And for me, that was the moment I was like, we need to preserve our indigenous food. We must preserve our indigenous foods. And that's how Addo Blooms was born.
Great. Such a great story. Like, what? I knew none of this. Yeah. Which is why, I'm always, I'm at a loss for words right now, because I should be used to this by now, because it's always like, I always look in line for people like, oh, I think this person has an interesting story. And then they come on the show and I'm just always 100% of the time just blown away by people's personal stories.
I'm glad.
and how they get here, right? And it's always so, so interesting.
Yes.
Great. That's amazing. And I cannot even imagine. I have a special empathy for people that have food allergies, because I cannot even imagine having to choose and pick what I can or cannot eat. That's challenging.
Yeah. It's a struggle, right? Especially when people are making like food in a larger quantity, right? And it's like, well, you don't eat meat, you don't want eggs, you don't need this oil. Like, are you okay? Are you sick? Are you alive?
Yeah, that's a lot. So Addo Blooms was born. Like, tell me about the name. How did you come up with the name?
So initially, when I came in 2017, a lot of our indigenous foods were also located in the northern part of Ghana, right? Like the millet and the sorghum and the fonio and all these foods, but it's still the part of the country that is most neglected, right? Politically, economically, in terms of the resources that go there. My mom in the north, my mom is from Navrongo. I was born in Bolgatanga, so the Upper East region. And so my mother's last name is Ada. Right. Oh. So the food I source, the baobab, it's from where she's from. So it's a town after where she's from, the women that I work with. And so Addo Blooms is really the concept of, if you eat food from its place of origin, you will bloom, because I'm sourcing food from my place of origin.
So
I guess that's where the name comes from.
It's like hat tagging strings. Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
That's so cool. And then let's talk about this idea of ancestral foods, like, because that's basically the premise. That's what actually attracted me, because I was like, that's different. I haven't heard anyone talk about our foods in this context. So maybe for the audience, let's define, maybe from your perspective, how would you describe or define ancestral foods?
Yes, I think, you know, for me, a lot of African food is told by other people, right? The narrative of what is African is constructed outside the continent, right? We look at Africa from a very white lens, from a very European lens. And we'll look at African food from that lens. In terms of the hierarchy of food, we look at French food as, you know, like romantic and exotic. And we look at other foods in that way. But when it comes to African food, it's something that is not branded, right? And if, not that it has to be romantic, but in terms of food that is desired.
Yeah.
And so a lot of the language that is used around African food, it really has a negative connotation. So for me, and connecting back to Addo Blooms, our foods are ancestral foods, because it's not just foods that are connected to our DNA. They're also foods that are connected to our great-great-grandparents, right? For me, food is not just food. Like, okay, so let me rewind, right? A person's ancestral home is a place of one's extended family, right? So an ancestor is a person's forefather, a forelder, you know, someone that came before, right? So any person that you or I are descended from. And then ancestral for me is also originating in a particular place, in a particular context, right? Mm-hmm. Something that is native, something that is indigenous to a particular place. So ancestral foods is just about the, but it's around the culture, the traditions, the storytelling, the festivities that is attached to a particular food. Right. When we look at millet, for instance, mm-hmm. millet is a part of the story of the people from Upper East. Right. The Frafra people is the story of why farmers grow it and why they plant it in June. You know, is the story of why they have an early millet and a late millet, and they use the late millet for festivals. Right. That's the first thing they eat for breakfast. Cocoa, diohu, mm-hmm. Farmers who have cocoa before going to the field. So there are stories around food. It's not just a grain that we cook and we consume and passing. And it's like, no, it's there are festivities, right? There are planting festivities. Yeah. There are harvest festivities. People have died saving seeds, right? People have lived, and elders in the communities are respected for saving millet seeds that have lived for 70, 80 years, right? So the seed is planted, that variety of seed is planted year after year for 70 years. So that's like ancestral food is about DNA, right? It's about culture, it's about tradition, it's about something that is native, something that is indigenous, something that carries my story before I even existed, you know? So I'm connected to that food from my mother's side that, right, that ate that food. It tells me something about what I should be consuming and what can sustain me. So all those connections that I've made over the years in terms of wanting to preserve and protect our indigenous food is where, for me, I call it ancestral food, because ancestral foods also give us the ownership of that food, particularly in the world where a lot of seeds are being genetically modified, right? Or particularly in the world where a lot of our story and our food as African people have been constructed by others. So yes, that's how I use ancestral foods.
Yeah, no, that's a great, powerful context, right? For us to think through, you know, you're right, like, and part of why I also got into this space is just that you would think for a continent as big as it is and for its contribution to like global food chains, that there would be more interest, more investment, more everything, really. And like you said, it's a complicated web of different things, and we'll talk about that in a little bit of why it doesn't have the place in the global food chain that it should. So you started to talk about millet, so I wanted us to do a little bit of that before we go into the break. So just from your perspective, or at least what you've highlighted on the Ada Blooms site in terms of what you produce and sell, I wanted you to maybe give everybody like a description. So we started with millet, so maybe let's describe like what it looks like, what it tastes like, what it's used for in terms of food preparation, and then we can go down the list of the other three superfoods, grains, whole foods, whatever you want to call them.
Sure. So the African continent actually has one of the largest diversity of cereals and grains. So we have three varieties of millet. We have the pearl millet, we have Guinea millet, and we have finger millet. So in West Africa, pearl millet is the one that is the bigger kind. It's almost grayish. It's like grayish in nature. So we grow pearl millet here, and then they grow finger millet in East Africa. Pearl millet, it's used, you can just cook it and eat it as if you'd cook and eat rice. Mm-hmm. It's also milled. Yeah, you can also mill it as a flour, and then you can bake bread with it. You can make flatbreads with it, or you can make porridges with it. So the famous cocoa, the Hausa cocoa that we have, it's made from millet, right, and spices. The other food is called tiozafi, which is also comes from the Hausa people as well. Mm-hmm. We also cook that, right? Diehu, we also cook that with millet as well. So millet is actually gluten-free. A lot of actually all African grains are gluten-free. Mm-hmm. It's gluten-free, it's nutritious, it's easy, it's easy to cook. And a lot of farmers in the northern part of Ghana love it because it's heavy and it stays in your stomach for a long time after you've consumed it in the morning. And it's nutritious. It's high in iron, it's high in protein, phosphorus, and all the nutrition that we need.
And then the next one, let's stay on grains and do fonio.
Yes, fonio. Oh man, fonio is it's one of my favorite grains. I love fonio for breakfast. Fonio is also one of the oldest grains. It's been domesticated for about 5,000 years in West Africa. It's really tiny. It's smaller than a sesame seed. It's one of the smallest grains you ever see. There are two kinds of fonio. There's the white fonio and there's the black one. They both have up to par nutritional value. Fonio is also gluten-free as well. It's delicious. You can make porridges with it. I love making porridges with it. Fonio is one of those foods that is incredible because it doubles up. When you put a quarter cup of fonio to make a porridge, and if you keep adding water and stirring it and adding water and stirring it, you could literally end up with a porridge for three people. For some reason, it doubles up. So it's an amazing grain. You can also fluff it up and cook it really lightly and have it with salads and so forth. Yeah.
Yeah, no, that's, and then I discovered fonio a couple of years ago, which was wild to me that I didn't even know that we had it. And you're right. It's so versatile too, right? So it's filling and it's incredibly versatile.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And then baobab, right? Or baobab. Yes,
that's next.
Baobab. That's just, I love it. I love it. I love it because the tree is so grand. I'm like, God must have a story about baobab, because if you've ever seen the tree, it just defies. It's a piece of like a previous world on earth that we are gifted to see, because it is so grand. It is so huge. It is just like, it's grand. The baobab tree has the baobab fruit, which is the fruit that I sell on the website. Mm-hmm. It's high in vitamin C, so the fruit naturally dries on the tree. Women will harvest it, break the shell, they'll pound it to separate the baobab seed from the powder. They use the seed now actually for oil, as the baobab oil, and then the powder is what I have. So it's high in vitamin C. You could use a powder for beverages. I used to make cold pressed beverages and I'll add baobab to it. You could use it for smoothie. You could actually make yogurt as well with the baobab, because it's a prebiotic, right? And most yogurts are probiotic. Yeah, so prebiotic feeds the good bacteria that exist in your stomach to multiply so you can digest food. It's also high in vitamin C, so it's really good for skin health. And if your gut is healthy, then your mind is also healthy, since there is that gut-mind connection.
And then the last one you have on your site available for sale is tiger nuts, right?
Yes, tiger nuts. tiger nut. It's not a tiger and it's not a nut. I feel like the name is very, very misleading in very ways. It's actually a tuber. So it's more of a tuber. It's a root vegetable, actually. And it grows under the soil's surface, so underneath. It looks like a grass. So it's great for... So you can eat the nut fresh. Sorry, once it's harvested, typically the sun dry it for about 2 weeks. You can soak it, you can blend it, and you can make a milk from it. So the same way that you would make almond milk or cashew milk, you could also make tiger nut milk. It's delicious. So good. Or you dry it and then you process it into a powder, like what I have, the ground tiger nuts. You can actually bake with it. It makes delicious cookies. You can make energy bites with it. Ground tiger nut flour is versatile. You could add it to oat flour and bake with it. It's really good. It's a great source of magnesium. It's really rich in vitamin E, vitamin C, and it's an amazing substitute for those that are lactose intolerant. So for me, so that's typically what I would use.
Yeah, it's so interesting to me that the first time I actually saw, because yes, I'm used to tiger nut in its nut form, and then also like as a beverage, I've seen like in Ghana as a beverage, but I'd never seen it in a flower form until like I feel like I saw it in Whole Foods or something, and I was like, oh, this is interesting. And I'm sure that no, like it's not connected to anybody from the continent directly anyway, but I saw that and I was like, I was excited to see, but I was like also I wonder where and how this ended up on this right here, you know. Great. So that's really awesome. And all of that is available on your website, which we'll share towards the end of the conversation here. One last question before we take a quick break is, where do you source all of this? So the grains and the whole foods, let's say.
So yes, all my foods are sourced from Ghana. I wish I could source it from other farmers. I do have people that see the business and they would like me to purchase because I'm funding my own business. Mm-hmm. So I can't buy as much as I would love to. So I source from Ghana. So the millet, I source that from a farmer called Baba Kumase, who's in the Zabile area. Yeah, So I source the tiger nut from a tiger nut farmer here. I source the baobab from Navrongo, and then the fonio farmers are in Tamale. I actually wanted to do an interview, with them, but they're in Tamale. So because I have a lot of food allergies, so food safety and how food, the health around or the hygiene around how food is processed is very important to me personally, but also in my work. So I don't want anyone to get sick of the food that they consume.
Yeah.
So I know the people directly to whom I source the food from.
Cool. And then is this available for sale like internationally or just in Ghana? Where do you...
So all my foods are actually not sold in Ghana. They're all sold in Canada and the US.
Okay. So that's great to know.
Yes. Canada, US online. I'm trying to make it available in Ghana. It's surprising. Like you wouldn't go to the market and get fonio, right? And it's like the food comes from here.
Yeah.
But you wouldn't easily, I mean, tiger nuts, they sell like on the street. So that's fine. But you can't find tiger nut powder or ground tiger nut.
Like I said, that to me, like I saw for the first time on shows here in the US. So that was interesting. Okay, so we'll take a quick short break. And then when we come back, I wanted to cover some interesting topics from your blog.
Sure.
Just to share the other aspect of what you do. So you have Ada Blooms, which is, you know, your product sales site, but then you also do a lot of writing around some of these topics. So I picked a couple of blog articles that you wrote and wanted to dive a little bit deeper, and then we can point people to those articles to go read the full story and get the fuller picture, if you will, the whole story.
Sure, thank you.
Okay, we'll take a quick break and we will be right back.
This episode is brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. There's a reason when you think of Wisconsin, you think cheese. Cheese is a huge part of Wisconsin's history and future. In Wisconsin, the state of cheese, the tradition of cheesemaking excellence began 180 years ago, before Wisconsin was recognized as a state. Immigrants traveled to settle in this lush, green hills of Wisconsin, bringing their cheesemaking traditions with them. These storied skills combined with the freshest milk available created a cheesemaking culture that is uniquely Wisconsin. Wisconsin's 1,200 cheesemakers, many of whom are third and fourth generation, continue to pass on old world traditions while adopting modern innovations in cheesemaking craftsmanship. Find your next favorite cheese at wisconsincheese.com.
We're back from the break, and now we're going to delve into a few articles on your blog, which is called Living the Ancestral Way, right? If you like that.
Yes.
Yeah, Living the Ancestral yes. Way. And so I just picked a few that, like, maybe from the titles, they were interesting to me, and wanted you to maybe expand on those a little bit so that when people go and read them, you know, they will now have your context, a little bit more of context from you. So one of the first ones that stood out to me, one, and I think one just by the virtue of the title, but also two, because I just had a conversation with someone who also had a frustration around how people define African food or the lens through which to look at African food. And so the first one I picked is called something about African food not being famine foods. Is that the right?
Yes.
Thing? Yeah, not being
famine
foods. And so this idea that just by virtue of the proportion of people that are undernourished by, you know, all the different definitions out there. We're just considered a famine, drought, and resourced from a food perspective place when the opposite is true. So I wanted to get your take on like why that is. And then two, maybe how do we then shift this perception?
Definitely. Thank you. Yes, this topic is so near and dear to my heart. I can go on for years, but I keep it short. You know, our continent has been framed as a starving continent for a very long time, right? And this is a false narrative, but it's a narrative that allows capitalism to be able to do what it does best, right? Where few people own the means of production. And to make certain key foods as the commodity, right? And for people to be able to buy and purchase those foods. So the devaluing of African foods happened during colonialism, right? When many native crops were branded as crops that could not make it to the New World, or were branded as crops that were not desired, right? Because they were not desired for the European market. Mm-hmm. So I'll give an example. For instance, cocoa is not indigenous to West Africa. But it's not, right? But we grow it so well. But chocolate is not a big part of our diet, right? Mm. We export 20%, but cocoa has a big value in the world market, right? Chocolate and cocoa has a big value in the world market because of who's buying chocolates or who's eating chocolates during Valentine and Christmas, right? It's clearly not people here. Right. So for me, it's always around who's telling the story, what benefits do they get from telling the story? Because cocoa can't feed families, right? When we're looking at food security and we're looking at whether grains or fruits or vegetables or leafy greens, you can cook and eat cocoa and feed your family, right? so it's always the devaluing of our food happening through colonialism. And so a lot of our indigenous foods were relegated as famine foods. And they were relegated as famine foods because they were consumed in rural areas. Mm. And foods like corn, maize, and wheat, these are foods that took precedence, right? Kind of became more popular in the world market, in the market. And it became popular, one, because your seeds were genetically modified, because they were cheaper to grow, and because there were bigger stakes for corporations that were promoting it, right? So maize, corn, is indigenous to South America. It's their food. But right now, it's been, since 1997, it's been modified to the point that we can all eat yellow and white corn, but we're not eating the actual corn. We're eating modified corn, But corn has also now substituted a lot of our indigenous food. So now corn is substituting a lot of millet foods here. But even in East Africa, ugali that they traditionally used to make sorghum, now all people use is corn, right? So our foods have been constituted as farming foods because it fits a certain kind of dominant food narratives. Every time I hear people say the continent is dying, and no, it's not. There's if you've ever been from farm to farm, there's an abundance of food. The challenge is that we import so much food that the foods that are grown locally are expensive, so people don't desire it, right? I'll give you an example. So within the African continent, we have our own indigenous rice, the Oryza gliberima.
Yeah.
We have been growing our own rice for thousands and thousands of years. However, the Asian one, Oryza sativa, over time, because it was genetically modified, it became easier to grow, right? Because once you modify the seed, you make it pest resistant, climate resistant, all these other things. Yes, the nutrition has been reduced 100%. Now it's easy for people to grow anywhere in the world. So over time, that particular variety took over and the African indigenous rice was relegated, right? Once you've also modified, it means it's easier to cook. When you put the white rice in the rice cooker, it's done in 10 minutes. The African indigenous rice takes 45 minutes to cook because it's indigenous. It's in its natural state. So what happens is that we frame foods that don't fit our fast moving society as backward, when in fact it's us, you know? So it's capitalism that has shifted and framed and devalued our indigenous foods because it wasn't foods that white people consumed. Right. And now that our foods are becoming foods that white people consume, they're superfoods because, like, oh my gosh, they're drought resistant. They're great. They're nutritious. But it's like, we've been doing this for years. Yeah. I recently saw a documentary called Earthen, where people are walking barefoot. And like, oh my, people are walking barefooted in Africa every day, but we call them poor. But rich people do it, right? So for me, and this is why I started the blog, because I think that it's important for us to tell our stories. Like, because other people have been telling our stories for a very long time. And so if we don't own and start telling our stories, then our foods will continue to be constituted as farming foods. Recently, I was part of a conversation where, you know, this organization is looking to do sort of a documenting of indigenous foods, but they kept referring to our indigenous food as forgotten foods. I'm like, you can come to the conversation. Yeah. Can you imagine you're doing, yeah, you're trying to look for your ancestors. You're like, oh, I'm looking for the castaways. It's just, there's already a narrative that you're coming to the foods, and that is problematic. Our foods are not forgotten foods. Because if you go to the rural communities, they're eating it. And they're not eating it because you're poor. They're eating it because that's who they are. And it's a part of their narrative and your story, right? So it's like, who gets to brand people eating their cultural foods as poor? Right. But when people are eating unhealthy foods, it's so bizarre to me. Like I said, I can go on about this stuff.
Yeah, it's 300 years. I know, it's all interconnected, right? So the sort of next blog piece I wanted to talk about was the one around like our food system, but you've actually touched on a lot of the pieces around that. So Abna has a very good article on her blog site about, you know, our complex food system. And one of the things that really stood out to me, and you mentioned it while you were talking about this idea of how our food is defined or named. I'm going to read it verbatim so that I don't misquote you, but because this really stood out to me when I looked at this particular piece around the food system. It said, there's something fundamentally wrong with a cocoa farmer who has bought their land, purchased their agricultural inputs, weeded, harvested, sun-dried, and sold their cocoa beans, but has never tasted chocolate. I just thought that was so powerful. And to your point that, you know, it's not chocolate that's going to feed their family, but it's also interesting that they don't see like the full spectrum, you know, of where their work ends up in a lot of ways. that was so wild. Yes. Like, I mean, I think I know that, but just seeing it in black and white, I think, was like, whoa, that's actually true. And then another interesting piece I thought was one around tracing your food lineage. And then talking about the foods that you grew up eating. So Choza Fi, Bambara beans, and all of that. I want you to talk a little bit about that. And this idea of one where you say you've never had jollof if it's not made with dawa dawa, which I was like,
yes.
I honestly did not even know that that was a thing. Did not even know that that was a thing until maybe in the last 12 months for a combination of reasons. One, working with a few people to open a restaurant in Accra called Dawa Dawa. And two,
sweet.
Yeah. Yes. And two, I think, I don't know. I saw somebody, some food blogger person. It was at a Ghana Food Movement event where, what's her name? Ooh, the food blogger. She's really good. She's everywhere. Oh, I can't think of her name right now. But she made a lot with Dawa Dawa, and I was like, oh my gosh. And then to realize that that's actually not a quote-unquote fusion thing, and that it's like, it's actually the way that it's been for a while was so wild to me. It was really interesting. And then the one question or the one thing that stood out from that tracing your food lineage piece was your question that says, if my great grandmother was to look at my plate, would she recognize the ingredients that she knew when growing up, right? And
yes.
I think about how powerful that is, because I remember growing up and having like millet wheat porridge and millet porridge and even like rice water, which is a porridge, which is all of these things I'm mentioning for those who are not familiar. They're all so different good. Sorts of porridges that which is essentially a water-based meal, I guess, cooked with a grain, yeah, a grain. So it could be the full grain or it could be the ground version of the grain, which is super nutritious. And like essentially, like we always had some sort of, you know, porridge, even if we had it with bread or something or kose or whatever on the side, like we always had some porridge growing up. So it could be Tom Brown. Well, I don't even know when the last time I saw Tom Brown. Anyway, Tom Brown, like rice water, you know, right? Those, all of that.
So good. So good.
Yeah. And I think that that's part of your ethos, right? In terms of putting this together in your work, that idea of like, would our ancestors, when they look at our plate, recognize what we're eating?
Yeah, I think, you know, there are a lot of health challenges that so many of us are facing now that, yes, is connected to stress, and yes, is connected to, you know, mental health, but a lot of it is also connected to food, right? And it's connected to the ingredients or the spices that we're using to make our food tasteful and delicious, you know? And now, you know, when a lot of people cook, there's all these other spices that are dancing in. And it's not single origin spices. It's not like you can say, it's okay, that's paprika, that's turmeric, right. It's maggi, right? It's like, what's in this maggi thing, right? Like what's in it? How much sodium is in it? So a lot of our health challenges come from the things that we're adding to spice up our food. And so for me, once again, going to the north, you're adding one or two ingredients that you're making. And Dawa Dawa is a big part of that, right? Mm-hmm. Dawa Dawa is a fermented flavoring that's added to stews, added to soups. The health benefits of Dawa Dawa are, it's incredible. It stings, it smells on its own, but in food, it's delicious. And so for me, you know, that article was about, because I believe that food is connected to our DNA, right? Mm-hmm. And for a lot of the illnesses that we face, really, we should trace back and ask, what were our great-great-grandparents eating?
Yeah.
Because that's the food we should be eating, right? Like our health comes from our gut microbiome, right? So our well-being, how we feel, the energy, all of that comes from the health of our gut. And the health of our gut comes from what our great-grandparents are eating.
Yeah.
And our gut has not, it has not what do I say? It has not evolved as quickly as technology has, right? Your gut health is not like an iPhone. You're not getting a new version every 2-3 years. It hasn't, right? And your grandparents were eating seasonally. Like right now, it's raining season. So people are consuming a lot of fresh, like, foods. When it's the dry season, people are consuming a lot of, like, grains, right? A lot of foods that are preserved. And so when you consume different foods, you allow for different cultures to build in your stomach. And so for me, tracing your full lineage is really about healing yourself with your own ancestral foods, or detoxing yourself with your own ancestral foods. But it was also around the simplification of cooking food and still making it delicious, right?
Yeah.
And also because dawa dawa is added to everything, you don't need to do super incredible spice gymnastics in your jollof stew to make it good.
That's like, the first I've heard of that, spice gymnastics.
People are doing spice gymnastics. It's like, how many spices are in this stew?
Yeah.
Because I have allergies, I'm particular.
You're probably sensitive to it.
It's just use ginger powder, garlic powder, and we're good. I think for me, like the dawa dawa jollof is, it's just a simple ingredient that has so much health benefits, and yet it transforms the flavor of food. Like you take a scoop of dawa dawa and immediately, like, your stomach, your tongue, your brain, your palm are all in alignment. It's almost like your grandparents is giving you a high five, right? Like you have the dawa dawa and it's like, yes. So for me, it's really around, how do we keep these foods alive? How do we keep a lot of these traditions alive, right? And eating dawa dawa jollof is also buying the dawa dawa probably from a market woman, and it's also supporting her, and then supporting a woman who probably had to climb the tree, you know, to unhusk the dawa dawa and to process it, because it takes about 3, 4, or 5 days. It's a long process to make dawa dawa.
This has been such an enlightening conversation for me. Like I go into these conversations having no idea really what, you know, outside of the loose, you know, sort of, I have loose ideas of what I want to touch on, but have no idea where the conversation will go. And so it's always well to me. And I feel privileged to be in this seat where I get to, like, engage with people like you, sort of take in, soak in all of your knowledge and expertise. And then hopefully, as you know, the audience that's listening, also are educated, enlightened, and are able to think a little bit more about, like, what goes on their plate, how they make decisions for, you know, what ends up in their kitchen and on their plate.
Yes.
So I appreciate your
thank
time.
You.
Before we wrap up here, what is your dream for Ada Blooms? Like, what's next? And then how can people get involved or help you with everything that you're doing?
Man, big dreams. We all have big dreams. I guess dreams keep us going. I would really love to open a store with a lot of indigenous African food. So it's almost like a museum meets a cafe, meets a home-cooked kitchen, meets, you know, as I travel, there's so many foods. I recently went to Ivory Coast and I saw so many different ingredients, so many different foods. I saw this akpi tree and this, just a lot of other foods. And I was like, wow, right? These are foods that are used in their cooking, but it's not used in our cooking, you know? And I thought, it's crazy how much food we have on the continent. And I would love if there was, like, a home for ancestral foods. That's kind of what I think of Ada Blooms as, to have this store where anybody who's traveled can get anything, whether it's, you know, a grain, a fruit, a vegetable, a tuber, a seed, just to come in and not just to see what the food looks like. It would be a store. It's like walking in a farm, really bringing a farm to the store where you could see what the food looks like in its raw state, right? And see what the food looks like, you know, like the seeds and all these other things. So it would be great to
be able
to open a store. Yeah, to be able to open a store like that, if the cost
so that our own kids one day will not say, when you ask them where, you know, where does whatever something come from, they don't point to a restaurant or something, you know. We don't get to that point. Okay, so before we transition to rapid fire, can you let people know, because we've talked about your blog, we've talked about, you know, Ada Brooms, can you know where people can find you online? So social media handle, the actual website.
Yes, thank you. So Ada Brooms is where I sell the products, the food products. So you can find me on Instagram or the website, adablooms.com. Living the Ancestral Way is the blog. It's where I can talk about the politics of food and all these other cultural, traditional food farming, agriculture. And you can also find me on YouTube. So it's called Living the Ancestral Way, where I just interview farmers, and also just as a visual way of documenting Indigenous African foods, but also food ways as well. So I'm on Instagram, the website, as well as YouTube. You can Living the Ancestral Way.
I will share all the links. I'll share the links to YouTube, the website, and then also to the blog, and then also the specific ones we talked about today, so that if people want to dive a little bit into those specific ones, they can do that. Our last piece, so this will just take a couple of minutes, quick rapid fire questions, just a little fun for people to get to know you a little bit better. So let's dive in. First question is, what is the one ingredient you can't live without?
I would say, honestly, it's between baobab and millet, but I'll say baobab. Okay. I'm so particular with food that if I travel with the baobab powder and all I have is water to mix it and drink it, I will be fine. Like I'm good.
Yeah.
Give me water and baobab, I'll be good.
Ooh, awesome. Okay. And then related to that is, if you could live on one dish for the rest of your life, what would that be?
Ooh, damn. I wish it was two. I'll say tizet. Diehu. Okay. I love tizet. Diehu. Yeah. Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Jollof almost made it, but he said
now Jollof almost made it. Your favorite season. So I know you lived in Toronto and you're also in Accra, so you can mix and match. It can be rainy season, dry season, it can be spring, winter, fall, autumn, summer.
In Toronto, after living there for 20 years, I used to love winter. In middle school, I was like, yeah, the winter. Became an adult.
Oh my gosh.
I used to.
I guess as a kid, maybe I could see that. Yeah.
Yeah. And then like as an adult, I'm like, I could hear my knees creak during winter. So now I'm just like, no. I actually really love the dry season in Ghana. Like from December, January, February. It's so beautiful, like especially when you go to the northern part. The land is so bare and the trees look like ghosts, you know, like they just zero. Just bare land, and you see these tall indigenous trees welcoming you home, but at the same time scaring you away. It's really lovely.
And then my final question, if you could meet one of these, which one would you meet? Your ancestors or your future descendants?
Ooh. Future descendants. I already know the ones behind me. I know what they look like. I see.
Why would you want to meet them? Like, what would you, like, what's the thought process behind that?
I think I would want to know what they did with the work that we're doing now, you know? You know, because for a lot of us, especially for you building this, when you do this kind of work, it's passion work, it's soul work, it's spirit work. And of course, your children can do their own thing, but they're parts and they're pieces of work that you do that you want people to preserve, right? And cherish and keep alive, even if they're not doing it. So it would be great. I think for me, it would be great to see how they where and carry the continent forward.
Oh, that's
so,
a good one.
It'd be good. Really good. Yeah.
Cool. Awesome. Well, that's it. That's it. Thank you so much for your time. It's been such a pleasure chatting with you. And like I said,
it was lovely.
I learned so much just from talking to you. And there's a lot for me to think about. I always leave these conversations with I have such an appreciation for everybody that's doing the work. And like you said, that's a good point. Like, it will be interesting to see what all of this means, you know, years from now, mm-hmm. decades from now. But yeah, good stuff. Yes. Well, thank you so much. It was such a pleasure to have you. Thank you.
Thank you for having me. It was lovely. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Item 13, an African food podcast. If you like the show, please subscribe, rate, and review us on your favorite podcast app. To keep up to date, follow us on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter at Item 13 Podcast. Item 13 is powered by Simplecast. Thank you for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.